You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest shares his stories about finding freedom and happiness by getting rid of most of his stuff.
First, Muslims around the world began abstaining from food and drink from dawn to dusk yesterday because of the start of the month of Ramadan. During this time, Muslims fast, avoid negative habits, and spend a lot of time in prayer and reflection.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar, which is based on phases of the moon. And when a calendar is based off the moon, the months fall during different seasons each year. A couple of years ago, Ramadan began in the winter. Now it's right in the middle of summer.
If you're not fasting over the next 28 days or so yourself, you might have friends or coworkers who are observing the holiday at a challenging time of year. Our next guest wrote an article on ways to support friends and colleagues in the middle of the fast.
Joining us now is Janella Massa. She's a Toronto-based reporter who's also Canada's first hijab-wearing TV news reporter. She wrote the article, How You Can Help Your Colleagues During Ramadan, for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail. Janella, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how do you personally feel observing Ramadan affect you at work? No eating, no drinking through the day.
Well, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you have to find the balance, because a lot of people probably think that Muslims dread Ramadan. It's this big, daunting challenge that we have to undertake for a month of fasting every day from before dawn until sunset. But it's something I actually look forward to, and a lot of Muslims look forward to, because you get together with family and you know, it's a moment for self-reflection. It's a time to think about those less fortunate. So there are some benefits. But at work, obviously, can be a little bit of a challenge. It depends on what kind of work you do. I always say the biggest challenge is not so much not eating, but the low energy that comes along with it. So I always find that I start to hit that wall in the afternoon, as most people do, when you might grab a snack. So for me, you know, and for my colleagues, they might notice that I get a little less chatty, a little, trying to conserve my energy and just kind of trying to get my work done quietly at my desk and not exert too much energy.
A lot of people don't necessarily want to bring up issues of religion and faith at a workplace, but does it help to talk about these things with coworkers, maybe bosses, to see how best to work with each other during this time?
I think absolutely, because, you know, on the one hand, fasting is a very personal thing. You know, you may not even realize that somebody is fasting until, you know, you get into an awkward situation where you invite them for lunch, or maybe there's cake in the boardroom and they say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm fasting. And that might be the first moment and you don't know what to do. So it is a good idea to open up that line of conversation and ask questions, because they also want to be able to perform well in the workplace. They don't want the fast to affect their workplace. But there are things that an employer can do, say, to help them out, depending on the type of work that they're in. So, you know, your employee may ask to shift their work hours to earlier in the day or later in the day. Or they may ask, you know, I don't need the full lunch hour because I'm not eating lunch. Can I just work through lunch and leave an hour early? Or can I work from home if that's an option? So kind of being mindful of the very long day that they're going to have, and if they have the option to, move their shift around. The other piece is if they're in a job that is obviously very physically strenuous, you know, that's something to keep in mind. If there is an option for the tasks that are going to be assigned, you know, if there is an option to give them a task indoors or that is less strenuous physically, so they can kind of conserve some of that energy, I'm sure they would really appreciate that.
Yeah, suppose there's a manager, a boss somewhere out there who's thinking, okay, I know I have some employees who are going to be observing Ramadan. I don't know what I could do to help. I'd like to, without getting into legal ramifications, which could be a whole different conversation.
Sure.
But if there's that boss, how do they make that approach? How do they talk to their employees to figure out what's going to work?
Yeah, I think the best thing is to ask them, you know, is there anything that I can do to help make your fast easier? As I mentioned, giving them those options of flexibility. Here's what we can do. You know, let's put you on an evening shift so you can sleep in the morning and start your day later, since you won't break the fast until 9 o'clock in some cities. So I think actually asking them if there's anything that can be done so that you can come to a compromise together about what works best. And you know what, some people, you know, if their job really is something that's physically strenuous, you know, if they're a construction worker, if they're a firefighter, or they're an athlete, they may decide not to fast. So that's something to keep in mind too, that not everybody fasts. People don't fast for a number of reasons, and there are a number of exemptions for fasting. If you're sick, pregnant, breastfeeding, you know, all of these kinds of things. So some people may actually choose not to fast, and they can give to charity instead. So also don't assume that everyone's fasting.
So maybe non-Muslims don't step up and help police your Muslim coworkers on their
exactly.
fasting.
This is not the time to become the fasting police. If you see someone eating a sandwich, don't shame them. you know, women don't fast when they're menstruating. So a lot of women often have that awkward conversation where they were fasting and then suddenly they're eating their lunch and their coworker comes and says, hey, I thought you were fasting. You know, that might not be something that they want to divulge. If they're taking medication because they're sick, you know, maybe they don't want to divulge their health issues. So, you know, yeah, don't become the fasting police if you see someone who is not fasting.
Talking to Janella Massa, she's a reporter in Toronto. Her piece in the Globe and Mail there titled How You Can Help Your Colleagues During Ramadan. Let's stay with those colleagues. Don't police the fasting. Got it. Are there, maybe I don't want to judge them, stupid questions, unpleasant things to bring up, maybe that people should steer clear of when
talking
about
Ramadan?
Well,
I always say no question is stupid. I'm sure most Muslims would prefer that you ask them. They won't be offended. If you are, they probably will tell you. Don't be afraid to ask. The one thing I always say is, like, don't feel like you can't eat in front of me. Don't feel sorry for me. Don't apologize if you offered me your wife's homemade brownies and you forgot that I was fasting. It's okay. We've chosen to fast, and we know that the world will go on without us. We will be okay. We will live. So enjoy your lunch and don't, you know, don't feel like you have to hide in the corner if you're, you know, enjoying a snack at your desk. It's fine.
Now, I understand Ramadan is a holiday that moves. It follows a lunar calendar, not the solar calendar, which means it may happen at different times during a calendar year.
Exactly.
And this time it's happening when the days are pretty long, meaning you're fasting for longer than you would in Ramadan's past.
Exactly. So, as you mentioned, the calendar shifts back about 10 days every year. So this is pretty much the longest it'll ever be because, you know, the summer equinox lands right in the middle of June, right in the middle of Ramadan. So that'll be the longest day of daylight, and we fast during daylight hours. So it definitely is a bit more challenging this year. And with the weather, you know, it's hot outside. You know, in years past, I used to fast in wintertime, and it was super easy. You know, you pretty much get up a little bit earlier to eat your breakfast. You come back from school or work, and it's just a couple hours, and it's sunset already. So this one is a little bit more of a challenge.
Now, you get to look forward to something fun at the end, it sounds like. Eid, am I saying that right? The festival after Ramadan ends?
That's right. So
what
are
happens?
Actually two Eids in the Islamic faith. This is one of them. The other one is the pilgrimage to Mecca for Hajj. So this is Eid al-Fitr. Essentially, you would usually go for prayer in the morning. You would visit family and friends. You give to charity on Eid. If we're talking about the workplace, one thing that's a little bit tricky, because you mentioned the lunar calendar, the end of the month, at the beginning of the month, is marked by the birth of the new moon. So you would see the tiny sliver of moon in the sky. And sometimes there's some discrepancy as to whether it was seen or not. So you may have people who are celebrating Eid on two different days, like a Monday or a Tuesday. Or your employee might tell you, you know, I need Eid off so I can celebrate with my family, but I don't know yet what it's going to be. I'm going to have to tell you the day before. So that's something that's a little bit tricky. But usually Eid is celebrated with family and friends. You get to enjoy your reward after fasting for 30 days and eating lots of treats and gifts and, you know, money for the young children and also a donation to charity.
Janella, I hate to ask you this in the middle of a fasting day, but what kind of foods do you look forward to on that Eid celebration?
I will tell you that when you're fasting, everything tastes more delicious when you break your fast. So it really does not matter what it is. Everything tastes delicious at iftar time. That's the time that you eat your meal. You know, so usually when I start to get to the part of the day where I'm starting to fade is when I start thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner and dreaming up all of the things that I'm going to eat. I know that, you know, lots of people have traditional foods, but it totally varies because Muslims come from such a huge, diverse ethnic background. So everyone has their ethnic foods that they love, and it might be different. There's no one kind of food, but everyone usually does break their fast with dates. That's a very common thing that you'll find in a Muslim household during Ramadan.
Janella, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Janella Massa. She's a Toronto-based reporter who wrote the article, How You Can Help Your Colleagues During Ramadan, for the Globe and Mail.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, Hillary Clinton appears to have enough delegates to secure her party's nomination, according to the Associated Press. We'll look at what this means for her, for Bernie Sanders, and the rest of the Democratic Party.
First, in case you hadn't noticed it yet, acquiring stuff is out of fashion. Getting rid of it is in. The tiny house movement, the rise of deep decluttering, and the move to store memories online are all evidence of a new way of thinking about our personal belongings. In a phrase, less is more.
Our next guest used to be a guy who bought stuff. He had a stressful, high-paying job, a tendency to buy things to make him happier. Then his life got turned upside down when his mother died and he went through a divorce. Instead of keeping things, he decided to let them go. Ultimately, he teamed up with his friend Ryan Nicodemus, and together they spread the word about letting things go. There's a new documentary out about them and the movement. It's called Minimalism, a documentary about the important things.
Joshua Fields Milburn joins us now. He's one of the minimalists and the author of the memoir Everything That Remains. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a clip from your new documentary directed by Matt DiVella. This is a little bit of your story.
Before I discovered minimalism, I think my life looked like pretty much anyone else's. I had a lot of stuff. Hundreds, thousands of books, DVDs and VHSs, closets full of expensive clothes. All of these things that I brought into my life without questioning. But when I started letting go, I started feeling freer and happier and lighter. And now, as a minimalist, every possession serves a purpose or brings me joy.
So I guess it's, in some senses it can seem counterintuitive that if you have less stuff, you'll be happier. Why does it work out that way, do you think, for you and I guess for a lot of people, Joshua?
I was sort of living the American dream, right? The six-figure salary, the big house with more toilets than people, and I kept acquiring things in the pursuit of happiness, but I realized that that pursuit was actually leading to my discontent, and I realized that if I was going to continue to try to pursue happiness, I chased happiness. The closer I got, the farther away it actually was. The new purchase, that high that you get at the checkout line, it doesn't last far past the checkout line, and so I realized that it wasn't about happiness. The focus should be on living a more meaningful life. And then, of course, the paradox there is happiness is a really beautiful byproduct of that. But living a meaningful life has very little to do with stuff. It doesn't mean that I'm a monk or that I think consumption is inherently bad. I think compulsory consumption is really our problem.
Does it seem like the core of your work, this is something you and your business partner and friend, Ryan Nicodemus, have been at for a while. Does it seem like that idea is taking flight right now, that minimalism is maybe going mainstream?
Yeah, I see a lot more people who are embracing the idea. We just went out on a tour bringing the documentary out to a bunch of different cities, and it's amazing to see who shows up, whether it's a 92-year-old great-grandmother in California, or it is a 13-year-old in Chicago, or a bunch of high school and college kids who show up in Dallas. And what's amazing to me is that while all these people lead considerably different lives, they all tend to share one thing in common, and that's that they're all striving to live a meaningful life with less stuff, but not just getting rid of the stuff. That's not really the point. I think you could go home, rent a dumpster, throw all your stuff in it, and be miserable. The point is to get rid of the excess stuff that happens to be in your way so you can figure out and focus on what's truly important to you.
Why does having stuff get in the way of doing that, of figuring out what's important?
Well, we all have the same 24 hours in a day, and I was so focused on so-called success and achievement, and a lot of that in our culture has to do with the accoutrements, the trinkets we amass in our day-to-day lives to say, look at me, I'm successful, I'm happy, I'm wealthy, I have something to contribute to the world because I have this large business title, or I have this, you know, this luxury car, or this large home, or whatever it may be. And so in many ways, we're sort of peacocking, we're showing off these trinkets, in an attempt to get other people to like us, realizing that, you know, we're trying to impress a bunch of people who, in most cases, could care less about the additional stuff.
You said before that, happiness was the byproduct of doing this, getting rid of stuff so you could focus on a more meaningful life. Why do you think that is? Why would that make us happier?
Well, when I look at what is a more meaningful life, what is an intentional or deliberate life, I look at five different areas for me. It's health, relationships, passion, growth, and contribution. And whenever I'm feeling discontented, it really means that my short-term actions, my daily actions, aren't in line with my long-term values. And I have to go back and look at those five areas and say, are the things that I'm doing with my time, do they serve these five areas? Because quite often we'll say that we have our priorities in order. We'll say our health is our priority or being creative is a priority. But our true priorities are how we spend our time. So if we're incessantly checking email or watching TV or, you know, going out to the bar to drink with buddies, like, there's nothing inherently wrong with those tasks. But if they get in the way of what our real priorities are, then all of a sudden that discontent starts to creep into our lives.
So, Josh, if we were to walk into your home, your apartment today, what would we see there? What do you have?
You know, my partner and I, we have a 3-year-old daughter. I think if you walked into our house, you wouldn't walk in and say, oh, my God, look at this minimalist family. You'd probably walk in and say, wow, they're pretty tidy. And it's because I don't own a lot of stuff. We don't own a lot of stuff, but everything that we do own, whether it's my car or my clothes or my kitchenware, it has a function. As I said in the documentary, every possession serves a purpose or brings me joy. But then, of course, the excess stuff is out of the way. But also, you never get there. It's not like you get down to your 1,000 items and now you're a minimalist and you're going to be happy, because it changes as time goes on. I'm 34 years old now, but 10 years from now, the things that add value to my life today may not add value to then. And so I have to keep asking that question, does this add value to my life? And if not, I have to be willing to let go.
We're talking about being a minimalist right now with Joshua Fields Milburn. He is featured in a new documentary about his work with Ryan Nicodemus. It's called Minimalism. And I want to ask you about that parent part of it, Joshua, because I'm a parent and I'm totally drawn to this idea of minimalism. But my kids are total pack rats. And we'll go for a walk, and in a single walk, they might find a straw they want to keep and crumpled paper and an empty gum container and a rock. And they don't want to get rid of it at the end of the day. So how do you do that? I mean, are there parts of your life or times in your life when you just can't be a minimalist?
Well, you know what? It's one of the reasons that I was really drawn to minimalism early on, because the first people I saw who were minimalists were sort of these peripatetic, you know, world travelers, and everything they owned fit into a backpack. And that was interesting to me, and I admired that. But it wasn't the lifestyle I wanted to lead. And that's why when we made this documentary, we went out there and we found a bunch of different minimalist voices. We have a guy in the film, his name is Leo Babalta, and he and his wife Eva, they have 6 kids, and they live in the city in San Francisco. And then we have another couple, Joshua and Kim Becker, who have a couple kids, and they live in the suburbs. And I think ultimately what I've learned from a bunch of different minimalist parents is that our kids are watching us, and we have to set that example for them. And quite often, if I'm not leading by example first, it doesn't matter what I say to Ella, who's our 3-year-old. It really matters what I do and the consistent daily actions that I put out there. And as you just mentioned, quite often kids are fascinated by just about anything. It doesn't have to be the latest, greatest, new, shiny object. Of course, the kids are being advertised to now nonstop. You know, the average person sees 5,000 advertisements a day, and of course, a lot of those are children. But we have to learn how to cut as many of those out of their lives as we can, try to reduce the number of inputs that come in. But we don't want to be draconian about it either. Kids are going to be kids, and they're going to want stuff, and that's okay. And sometimes we have to set up rules or boundaries, but ultimately it's them who's watching us. We need to behave as the appropriate example for our kids.
So give me an example of that. If you wanted to set a good example, what would you do around your kids so that they'd see you and what you're striving to go for there?
Sure. I'll talk to you about one of our readers at one of our events showed up, and they were talking about their kids and how every time they bring home an art project, and I've employed this rule myself now, but every time they bring home an art project from daycare or from school, they, of course, want to put it on the fridge, right? And so the mom would say, yeah, that's great. I don't like saying no to my kids, so I'll always say yes as long as it makes sense to say yes. So then we'll say, what piece do you want to remove? So realizing that saying yes to one thing means I have to say no to something else. But if you frame it in a way that allows them to make that decision, to pick between those things and decide what thing to let go of, it's not forcing them to let go. It's giving them that sense of agency so that they're more willing and more accepting of the things that they are going to let go of.
So, Joshua, if somebody's listening right now and they want to try this minimalism, how do they start, especially if there's someone who's got a lot of stuff? Can you just give us a beginning step or two?
Certainly. Two things. First off, start with a question. How might your life be better with less? And the reason that question is so important is it helps us identify what the benefits of minimalism are for you, because they're different for all of us. Initially, for me, it was just finances and then regaining control of my health and relationships. All these other things came after that. But the benefits might be different for you. And then if you want some practical tips on decluttering, I think decluttering is kind of boring, personally. So Ryan and I found a way to make it a bit more fun. It was something we call the 30-day minimalism game. All the details on that are at theminimalists.com/game. But I'll give you a quick overview. Basically, you partner with someone at the beginning of a month. You each decide to get rid of some things throughout the month. It starts off really easy. On day one, you each get rid of one item. Day two, two items. Day three, three items, so forth and
wow.
So on. Starts easy, so you get that momentum you need, but it gets much more difficult as the month proceeds. Whoever goes longest wins. If you both make it to the end of the month, you've both won because you've each gotten rid of 500 items, and that's a pretty good start.
Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Joshua Fields Milburn, one of the minimalists. He's the co-author of the book Everything That Remains, a memoir, and he's featured in a new documentary about his work with Ryan Nicodemus. It's called Minimalism.
Coming up, we'll talk about Democratic politics and what's next for Hillary Clinton now that she appears, by one calculation, to have enough delegates to win her party's nomination. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, 6 states go to the polls today as primary season wraps up. Join us on the Ideas Network for special NPR coverage of the last hurrah of the race until the conventions. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, it appears that the Democrats may have their nominee. According to a count by the Associated Press, who contacted some superdelegates, Hillary Clinton had secured the support of enough of those delegates to clinch the Democratic presidential nomination when the party convenes at its July convention. The announcement came yesterday, a day before this last round of state primary elections.
Bernie Sanders and his campaign are calling the AP's declaration a rush to judgment and say that they shouldn't be counting the votes of superdelegates before they actually vote at the convention this summer. Sanders supporters also say a win in California's primary today could give him a big boost going forward.
Lily Gorin is back with us now. She's professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. Lily, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Happy to be on.
Well, we saw this from the AP yesterday saying Hillary Clinton had enough pledged delegates and superdelegates who said they would vote for her to reach the magic number she needed. What was your first thought when you heard that news yesterday, Lily?
I was a little befuddled because I was waiting for the primaries today.
And I've seen reporting that Hillary Clinton's campaign wasn't necessarily interested in seeing that yesterday. They were hoping to have the victory party tonight.
Yeah, I think that they were, and they were hoping to have it be a kind of symbolic party as well, as she will become the first female nominee from a major party. And so the AP sort of announcement yesterday was really kind of like, I was sitting at home and my husband said, "What happened?" And I said, "I guess they counted some superdelegates and they got to a total and then they announced it."
A little anticlimactic, like Citizen Kane, they mention what Rosebud is, 10 minutes in or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's a weird anticlimactic moment in what's been an eventful campaign so far, but it's the campaigning isn't really over, and it won't be even after tonight's voting, I wouldn't guess. What do you think about the Sanders-Clinton race?
No, I mean, I don't think that everything is over, certainly, for the Democratic nomination, but I do think that after the voting tonight, you'll have more clarity with regard to pledged delegate totals. The AP canvas was a canvas of the superdelegates, and, you know, they sort of called a bunch of them up who maybe they hadn't decided yet, and a number of them said, yeah, I'm going to support Hillary Clinton, but that still isn't necessarily the number of pledged delegates on either Sanders' side or Clinton's side. And so tonight you'll have, you know, a large chunk of folks who delegates from California, also New Jersey, and smaller groups coming out of South and North Dakota, and I think also Montana.
And we've heard the reaction from Bernie Sanders himself, his campaign, his supporters, saying, hey, AP, too soon. This is a rush to judgment. You can't count superdelegates until they actually make their votes at the convention. They could switch at any time. Do you think there's something to be said for that, that the AP, other media organizations saying Hillary Clinton is now the presumptive nominee based on this count? Do you think that's wrong to do?
Well, I mean, again, the pledged delegates, or excuse me, the superdelegates can certainly change their minds. They have that opportunity to do that, and they can do that up until the convention. But a lot of times, as the races have unfolded, the superdelegates have, you know, sort of said, well, you know, I finally made up my mind given the preponderance of the evidence this way or that way. And that's also what happened in 2008 with regard to superdelegates who came ultimately to support Barack Obama. As you know, we got to the end of the primary season, and so it's, you know, the prerogative of the superdelegate. They certainly can change their mind, but you also are talking about you know, a lot of votes that have already been counted from the previous states that have voted in caucuses and primaries and so forth.
And this would be a case where, for a change to happen, superdelegates would have to go against the overall pledged delegate count. And against the overall population that's voted for one candidate or another. So this would be a tall order, it sounds like, to convince your average Democratic superdelegate to change from Clinton to Sanders.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, because there's you know, again, you've had quite a long primary battle at this point, again, like 2008, but you also have a substantial difference in the number, in the numeric totals of how many people have voted for Hillary Clinton and how many people have voted for Bernie Sanders. And there's about a 3 million vote difference there. And that's fairly substantial. And so for superdelegates to, first of all, having come out and said, oh, I'm going to support Hillary Clinton, and then changing when it gets to the Democratic convention, they are, in fact, potentially defying the will of the voters in a lot of states and the number of pledged delegates that have come out of all of those contests.
Now, people are voting today, New Jersey, California, a couple of the biggest, four others along with that. The math doesn't look good for Bernie Sanders. Even if he wins some of these states, he probably won't win the overall thing. But for Hillary Clinton, does it look bad if she's having close elections, even losing states, kind of backing into the nomination?
Well, I think that the comparison to 2008 may be a point to pay attention to, in that the race in 2008 was actually a lot closer in terms of both the pledged delegates and the actual vote counts. There was a difference of a couple thousand votes between Clinton and Obama, actually Clinton having about 1,000 or 2,000 more votes. But the way that the votes were and where they were in terms of the delegate, the pledged delegate numbers, Obama had more pledged delegates. And so you got to the sort of end of the primary season and you had a closer race than the one that we have right now. So I'm not necessarily sure it's totally accurate to say that she's kind of backed into the nomination this time around. But, you know, she's had strong success in a number of states. She's lost to Sanders in a number of states. And of course, you're right, California is a big state, 475 or so pledged delegates in California, obviously a very diverse state, the largest populous state in the country. It's an important state and one that it would be beneficial to her campaign as she moves into the sort of broad general election to have said, you know, to be able to say strategically, I also carried California. I don't know what's going to happen at the end of the voting. It looks in California, from the polls that I've seen, fairly close.
Talking to political science professor Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at the presidential race, the news out from the AP, according to their count, Hillary Clinton has the combined total of pledged delegates and superdelegates who have committed to her to be the presumptive nominee. And in a moment like that, Lily, if you're the opponents, the Republicans, and you now know for sure the other candidate is who it's going to be, what you'd probably want to do is talk about that other candidate, ramp up the attacks. Instead, Republicans are talking about what Donald Trump said about a judge in this Trump University case and his Mexican heritage. Republicans probably not happy at this moment, I would think.
Well, strategically, it's a more complicated spot in which to find yourself as you're potentially turning to face the likely nominee in the other party. And so you're moving from the primaries and the caucuses to the general election. And so it's a time for each side, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats. The Democrats have to worry about, Clinton has to worry about Sanders and Sanders supporters and having a unified party behind her as she moves into the general election. And Trump is still in this kind of negotiation in a lot of ways where, you know, people have come out and said that they are going to vote for him, but then they're also criticizing a lot of the things that he's saying in his speeches and off the cuff and in news conferences and so forth. And it's a complicated place, and it also doesn't necessarily strengthen the candidate himself.
And there was talk that Donald Trump would pivot from his pugnacious primary persona to being a more presidential candidate. Accidental alliteration there. I wasn't trying. But it seems clear that he's not doing it yet.
He's gone back and forth, right? And we've seen him, you know, sort of give more refined speeches and sort of coherent speeches, but then you have these kind of, as you say, sort of pugilistic attacks on the press with regard to investigations into not only Trump University, but also the donations to the veterans groups. And then he's made attacks on the press, and he's been attacking this judge now for 2 weeks. This has been a story now for over 2 weeks. And it's also forcing a lot of people who are running for election on the Republican side of the ballot to have to comment. The media keeps asking people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to comment on what Trump is saying. And so even if they're not running themselves, McConnell is not running himself as for his Senate seat, but other people are, and they keep having to answer questions about what Trump is saying. And so it doesn't necessarily help Trump's campaign, and it's certainly not helping campaigns like John McCain running for his Senate seat, or Kay Oda in New Hampshire running for her Senate seat, and Paul Ryan is running for his House seat. I don't expect he'll have much of a battle for it, but he has to comment as well.
We're talking right now with political scientist Lily Gorin from Carroll University. The Associated Press says Hillary Clinton now has enough delegates to secure her party's nomination. We're looking at what that means for her, Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Party, and the general election.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the AP's announcement that Clinton is now the presumptive nominee? If you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, what do you think about all this? Should he drop out of the race or continue making a push all the way to the convention? And can the party unite around Clinton one way or the other? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with political scientist Lily Gorin. The Associated Press says Hillary Clinton now has enough delegates to secure her party's nomination. And we're looking at what that means for her, for Bernie Sanders, and the Democratic Party.
What do you think about Clinton as the party's presumptive nominee? How do you see the Democratic Party moving forward after a sometimes messy primary battle that's not over yet? What role should Bernie Sanders play going forward? What are you watching for in the general election in the months between now and then? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lily, before we go to the callers, Hillary Clinton, there was some talk about how she would take on a head-to-head race with Donald Trump. Would she be able to go on the attack, or would they want kind of a bulldog vice presidential candidate? She did a foreign policy speech that was a lot more about Donald Trump's foreign policy statements than her own policy. What did you make of that?
I mean, I think there's now a move, and she's been sort of doing this for a little while, working on the assumption that she was going to be the nominee, to take on Donald Trump and to move in the direction of, you know, sort of focusing attention on the campaign against Trump. And so, you know, when you get in a general election, you have two candidates. And so part of it is you are advocating to voters to vote for you, but part of it is you're advocating to voters to vote against the other candidate. And I think that in this context, Hillary Clinton has been sort of trying to refine the attacks on Trump to explain to the American people in her from her position why they should be voting against Trump and thus voting for her.
Go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Ben on the line in Milwaukee. Ben, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think it's just a little bit frustrating that the Associated Press is actually calling the election already, considering that they're taking into account the superdelegate count, which isn't being voted for until July. And this has been a consistent issue with myself and I think many voters. That the Associated Press is continually associating the superdelegate count with who is the presumptive nominee and who could become the Democratic nominee for the presidential race.
So, Ben, I want to ask the pledged delegate count. Hillary Clinton has a big lead there. And then you throw in the superdelegates. That's what puts her over the top, according to the AP. What do you think would happen that many superdelegates would switch to be enough to overcome that pledged delegate lead that Hillary Clinton has? What would it take, do you think?
Well, I mean, she does have the pledged delegate count lead, which, you know, is something to pay attention to. However, tomorrow is a big day. We have California coming up, and today is a big day with California's results coming in. I just feel like it needs to be waited for. It would make her look like a stronger candidate if the pledged delegate lead was to stay consistent and if it was to stay true to what she has for the lead right now.
Ben, thanks a lot for that call. And that's an interesting point, Lily, and this is something that has been an issue on election nights, you know, the big election nights in the past. Don't start sharing results while people are still at the polls. Is this something that maybe the AP saying this could affect voting today? People might say, oh, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, but it looks like we lost. I give up. Or I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter. We've already won. I'm not going to bother.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest problem with what the AP did and the timing of it. Right. And both the Clinton and the Sanders campaigns came out last night and then again this morning and encouraged their voters in California and New Jersey and South Dakota to make sure they got to the polls today, even though the AP had made this conclusive declaration. And this, you know, it's a little bit different than when, you know, polls close across the country in different time zones. And we've had, you know, the announcement of a winner, say, of a presidential race before the polls close in California, which is something that happened in the 1980s. And so there have been some rules associated with that. This is a slightly different situation, but it certainly presses on the same issues that you're going to deter people from voting if you tell them that their vote essentially doesn't count.
Right. There was a similar call for the Republicans, but I think by the time it was made, there was only one candidate left. There was a notice that, some people in North Dakota committed to Trump. Now he's got the number. But there wasn't anybody left to vote for at that point.
Yeah, because Cruz had left the race.
Mm. So, Ben, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Jim on the line in Fontana. Jim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to respond to your question, which is I think Bernie should stay in all the way. I think he should be solidify his position as the leader of the Progressive Party, both to move the platform, but more importantly, help Hillary get elected and then, you know, be a force in influencing her. We've seen, you know, a progressive candidate in Obama get into the White House and then, you know, try to placate everyone and be pushed this way and that way. If we can get Hillary in, you know, I think she can learn from her mistakes in the past. I think she's obviously smart, obviously capable. If we have a strong progressive movement reminding her what this country needs, and we finally have a leader in that for that movement, and Bernie, I think it'll be fine. I'm not worried.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Interesting perspective there, Lily. Bernie Sanders, even if he no longer has a realistic shot to become the presidential nominee, has clearly outperformed what anybody, I think including Bernie Sanders, thought at the outset. Is there a message here that Hillary Clinton and her supporters should be learning and including Bernie Sanders in spreading that message?
Well, I mean, I think that's a lot of what the dialogue has been in the last couple of months, is the fact that the Sanders campaign has influenced the discussion and has influenced and highlighted a lot of policy areas that a lot of Democrats, either Clinton supporters or Sanders supporters, are in favor of in terms of raising the minimum wage and income inequality, and has brought those issues to the forefront. And the question then becomes, you know, sort of moving, if you're going to elect Hillary Clinton president or a Democrat president, then there has to be a little bit of unifying of the party, both from the Sanders camp and from the Clinton camp. And again, you saw this a lot in 2008 when there was a lot of dissatisfaction among Clinton supporters, the famous PUMA movement, party unity, my blank blank. And there was a press between, you know, Clinton and Obama to come together, to lead the party together, and to move forward as, you know, a sort of unified Democratic Party. And that's, to some degree, if there's going to be a successful election of a Democrat, that's probably what some of the outcome needs to be.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at the latest in the presidential race, the call from the AP that Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee based on pledged plus superdelegates. Lily, once she is the acknowledged presumptive nominee, I think there's some expectation that President Obama will be campaigning for her maybe more actively. There's always a question, how much do you want the previous president out there? Bill Clinton was left a little behind for Al Gore there. Would President Obama on the campaign trail actively be a benefit for Hillary Clinton?
I think given the current state of Obama's poll numbers, that he is an asset at this point, particularly to Democratic crowds, and particularly in the African-American community and in a variety of communities that are Democratic leaning or supporters, that he does provide a kind of getting out the base, energizing the party. And so I think in a way that's quite distinct from Bill Clinton's situation at the end of his presidency, when he was coming off of an impeachment and a sex scandal that the Gore campaign sort of wanted to distance themselves from, that at this point his numbers are above 50%, and that's an asset to sort of encouraging Democrats in the fall.
Speaking of Bill Clinton, he's been a mixed blessing sometimes for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
This election, the last time around when she was running against Barack Obama. Is he front and center or will he be?
I don't run strategy for the Clinton campaign, so I don't know. And Bill Clinton is a complicated sort of symbol within the Democratic Party. He, you know, there are a lot of people who love Bill Clinton. There are a lot of people who detest Bill Clinton. And so he has, again, his strengths and weaknesses. And he will probably be used strategically. I think that there will be moves to sort of engage him in particular communities and particular states where his numbers and a lot of people are really fond of him, and probably less so in other areas.
Lily, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
We've been talking to Lily Gorin. She's a professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. She was with us to talk about Hillary Clinton's campaign and Clinton now having enough delegates to become her party's presumptive nominee, according to a count by the Associated Press. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.